Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're lucky to have with us Kate Walbert, whose latest novel is The Sunken Cathedral. Kate's previous works are Where She Went, which was a New York Times notable book, The Gardens of Kyoto, Our Kind, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and A Short History of Women, which was one of the New York Times' 10 best books of 2009. Her short fiction has appeared in the New Yorker, two specifically, The M&M World and Playdate. If you're a parent, M&M will scare the bejesus out of you. I've had four kids who have been in that store, and it hasn't happened there, but in Target it happened. Well, you'll read it.
Oh, my God.
From 1990 to 2005, Kate taught at Yale and now lives in New York, a city with which she is intimately familiar, as you'll be able to tell from The Sunken Cathedral, which is indeed a novel, but more so than not, perhaps. It's an essay on time, the past that rushes upward from what is sunken to the present, which kind of wobbles back and forth for all of us, and the future, which in this book is a kind of post-apocalyptic world in which all merges, surrounding and informing, which I kind of hate that word, is the concept of the Drunken Cathedral, a piece by Debussy, which I have drunk in, no pun intended, since I was a child and first realized the possibility of worlds which are here but again may not be. It may have been because of the cartoon, The Land of the Lost Toys, which I also loved. And we live in a world where we need not construct or hypothesize about music or magic. Magic is all around us in the form of time, time which creates a nimbus around a life, ours, Marie's, Elizabeth's, Helen's, Simone's, Sid's, all characters in the novel. The recollections they summon up, oftentimes in strategically placed footnotes, aren't necessarily happy ones, but they give us entry into a world of a policeman, a lost cousin, a gone but not so gone husband. And when that happens, we too recollect and footnote our own lives, our psyches, and our ideas of happiness, of what comes after. Where do we find our loved ones after they're gone? In a sunken cathedral, listening to bells tolling far away? Perhaps we do. And with that, thanks, Kate, for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. That was such a beautiful summation. I'm speechless.
No, you can't be speechless. It's an
okay,
interview.
I'm not speechless, but that was great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Hey, the cover of the book is really cool. I like to talk about the covers first because since I own an independent bookstore and everyone always says don't judge a book by its cover, everybody who walks into the bookstore does.
Of course. So there's a little story behind that cover, which is the art director at Scribner, who's fantastic. She decided what she was going to do was go take some photographs of just New York City neighborhoods with brownstones, and then she took the best photographs and literally went to the pet store, bought an aquarium, took it to her office, filled it with water, and put the photograph into the aquarium, and then reshot it through the water. So that's where the image comes from. It is literally a sunken neighborhood in New York.
That's so funny. I kept thinking, oh, they really photoshopped this and did all
right,
kinds of
right. No, this is the real thing.
And it's funny, after I go to the cover, then I go to the epigraph, and lots of authors aren't asked questions about that. But I always think if an author takes the time to have an epigraph, I always think, well, wait a minute, this kind of encapsulates the book. And this is by Lauren Isley, which is, "Our identity is a dream. We are process, not reality. For reality is an illusion of the daylight, the light of our particular day." And that kind of is a thread that runs throughout the whole book, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think that the book is really about the permanence of impermanence, if you will. I mean, it's not something I was necessarily thinking of as I wrote the book. I always figure out what my books are about after they've already I've finished them. So I don't write with any kind of great intention or big idea, but I realized after I'd finished The Sunken Cathedral and put the pieces together, that that's truly what it was about. The fact that it depends on the slant of light, it depends on the mood you're in, it depends on the objects of your life, what you surround yourself with. It depends on how you walk down the street on a particular day. That's the accumulation of what is the permanence of your world, and it can all be shifted. It can shift in a moment's time.
Yeah, it's like that movie Sliding Doors. You know, you can pick.
Right.
Well, your whole life is like that. You make so many choices that, you know, walking
right.
into a room or saying, do I love her, do I not love her? And that changes your entire life.
Right. There was just this play on Broadway. I think it was called Constellations. I might have the name wrong, but it was essentially the same scene told over and over and over again, but with just a little detail missing each time it was acted. So in one moment, the female lead says to the male lead, oh, my husband's getting me a drink. And the next time the scene is played, she says, my fiance's getting me a drink. And how that shifts all the dynamics of that moment in that scene, just the tiny shift in how people relate to one another.
That's pretty cool. I would like to see that. Oh, that reminds me, too, about nuance. I read the book in writing as book form, but then I saw that you had also... in the audiobook version, you read it yourself, correct?
Right, I did. That was a big leap for me.
And it was funny because the first page, when the water is coming over those sticks that are arranged as if they're almost arranged purposefully, and you say there was pressure there. And when I read the book, I thought, that's cool. That word really means a lot more than just the word stuck in the middle of the page. And then when you said it in the book, too, it really did, too. And I'm thinking, wait, this is just one word.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right? I mean, it meant something. It's like it kind of kicked something for me. But I don't know why. The idea of pressure, I don't know what it was. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I think it's the undercurrents. It's the shifting tides. It's the sense that you look at it. You look at water and it looks fairly benign.
Exactly.
And yet we all saw those images of New York flooded during Hurricane Sandy, and suddenly it was the river was no longer benign, and there was pressure there. But also I think that the way I work, I'm really taking my dictation, in a sense, from the particular words on the page. And by that I mean that because I am not writing from any kind of predetermined idea or intention or outline, when I write a word like pressure and it feels right, then it's as instructive to me in continuing to write the book, in unraveling the book and trying to figure out what the book is about, as it will be mysterious or curious to you as the reader. You know, it has a certain weight in the sentence. And that's interesting to me when I write it, as much as it may have been interesting to you reading it. And that then informs the later sentences of the book.
I think people don't realize that water, yes, is a benign force, but that it has more power than almost anything in the world, like in a tsunami, like what happens kind of in the book. It's just
right.
that it's unstoppable, and
you
can't stop it.
Right.
Which is interesting because there are themes like that in the book. For example, like Sid, when he's talking about blue, and
mm-hmm.
that blue doesn't occur in stone. And then when they first walk in and Simone says, white is everything when seen,
mm-hmm.
and blue is not, you know. And blue is my very favorite color, and it also mm-hmm. evokes the sunken cathedral and other things. But what is it about the blueness of things, especially that they're not grounded, that made you come back to that repeatedly in the book?
The color blue.
Yes.
Well, again, I think it just became a trope for me. You know, I hear details. I think I got that from being at a museum and reading a short description of someone who used blue, and then in that description there was a line about blue not being found as other colors are found as easily. And so when I when I read something like that, it's going to somehow weasel its way into my work so that I sound as if I know a lot more about what I'm talking about than I actually do. I mean, it's just that detail that then, oh my gosh, you know, for me, that becomes a metaphor, and that becomes an interesting stone to worry, in a way, throughout the book. I think that's what Blue did.
Hey, you said stone to worry, and Blue doesn't come in stones.
Right. it contains its contradictions, right? Multitudes.
The thing about it is not for every reader, but for me and probably a lot of them, that Blue is so evocative. And that's what's cool about it is that, yeah, maybe you saw it or heard it and you put it in there, but it becomes very evocative for the reader. One of the other things that's cool is that with Simone and Marie, these two French girls who are really not girls, they're old, how are you able to, and why did you, make Simone such a flirt? And, you know, how do you go about making old people attractive? Is it, you know, hand lotion and rubber gloves? Is it lipstick? Because you do exactly the opposite in another part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you choose to, and how did you go about? Because it's a difficult task, making them in some ways as attractive as they must have been when they were young girls. Especially,
well, I think it maybe it comes back to, in the book, the sense that that impermanence, the sense that, you know, we might physically grow old, but our emotions do not. And they're perhaps as vivid as they were when we were 16 or 12 or first met our husbands. I think I was playing around a little bit with that idea. Eudora Welty said it in One Writer's Beginning. She said, emotions do not grow old. And I remember when I read that line and thought, that's so simple, and yet it's so true, and I'd never really thought about that before. We think because we're aging that our feelings necessarily age as well. So I guess with Simone being a flirt and still putting her hands in gloves at night to keep her skin soft and having a bit of a liaison with Sid Morris, who's another character in the book, who is teaching them in the art room. He's the art instructor, and both Simone and Marie, who are both octogenarians, are taking these art classes, obviously quite late in life. But I think for Simone, she's still a flirt. Once a flirt, always a flirt. And the fact that she's 80-something doesn't really make a difference. That's how I experienced her when I was writing it. You know, you really have to, when you're working, you're just trying to get as close to the character that you're writing about as you can, so that you can stand in their shoes and see the world through their eyes. And for Simone, who's just lost her husband, Sid Morris was a welcome distraction, and it's just second nature to her once and always to be attracted to men.
It's funny, most of the reviews, or some of the reviews, say, you know, they're trying to describe your characters, and they don't do a very good job of it, but they say that, you know, things come back to Marie, mm-hmm. and in the other sense, things come back to Elizabeth,
mm-hmm.
and then you very adroitly put them in the same home, along with the famous actor who, I think if you do a movie, has to be John Malkovich.
Oh, that's a good one.
But the funny thing about the book is that everybody pretty much is good. I mean, Abe was a really cool guy, and so is Jules, and in a way, no, in many ways, so is Ben, even Simone, the flirt, and Pete, and even Bernice and Dr. Constantine, especially when they go to the bar, they're all good. So where's the, I don't know, the Voldemort, the evil? Is it the weather? How can you create a book in which there's tension, but all the characters are kind of, you know, really good people?
You mean so there's no foil?
Yeah.
He who shall not be named.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really interesting question. I think I would have to say it's time. It's time and the wearing down of life through time. And if there was one thing they were all fighting, you know, the one big force, dark force they were all fighting, was trying to understand how we live our lives in the face of time and in the face of time passing. And so for Marie, for instance, who's lost her husband many years prior to the opening of the novel, one of her first thoughts is, how is it possible that I'm alive and Abe is dead? Abe is, was her husband's name. I mean, this is a very simplistic thought, but profound for her. How is it possible that I'm continuing to live and he's no longer here? And where is he? Where is all he studied? Where is everything he was about? Where does it all go? And I think for all of them, all the characters, although I haven't thought about it before, but it's a great question. I think for all the characters, that's what they're ramming up against. And yeah, that, in a way, is the metaphor of the water flooding the West Side Highway, of the water sinking the cathedral in the famous story of the island off of France that inspired W.C., of water rising, which, I mean, a lot of people have talked about the book in terms of, you know, this is references to global warming, and obviously they're there, but really the greater image for me is the water as a metaphor for time, really.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's so many post-apocalyptic novels, and I guess
right,
you could
right.
possibly put this in the pocket of that, but it's
right.
not at all. I mean, it's not at all.
No.
Even the last scene when Ben is walking with his mom,
right,
and the sand cakes and all that, that has nothing to do with the fact that there's nobody left on Earth.
Right.
Even
right.
if that's true or not, I'm not trying to give anything away. It's not,
right.
that's not what it's about. But it's funny when you said about water, because then I thought of Elizabeth and her memory.
Yes.
That's summoned up. And again, water is what happens. Water is
right.
what drags
right.
people down. You know, it's funny because the first footnote, Marie finds it almost unbearable that Abe is dead and she is alive. That goes directly to the thing that the reviews talk about a lot. So you have these footnotes, which are unlike David Foster Wallace's footnotes, which are like entire novels at the end of the book in Infinite Jest, whereas yours are really accessible because you have a blue star or star and then asterisk, and then right underneath it is the footnote, which is conveniently usually composing part of the bottom of the page, sometimes rolls over, but you don't really miss a clue. So your footnotes are there for a reason, and you decided for a reason to do it that way when people primarily invoke the past or invoke their thought process. But why did you do it that way, which is in every review?
Right. I was really surprised how often that was remarked upon in the reviews. It seemed to be the thing that everybody went to and, thought was sort of interesting to talk about with the book. And obviously, you know, you can't start writing footnotes in fiction and not think about David Foster Wallace. So, of course, I thought, okay, this is the last thing I want to do, is to have footnotes in fiction. I can't do this. It's already been done. Enough said. And then, I've said, but it's really true. They kind of insisted upon themselves as footnotes. I would find myself going into a kind of a disruption, for lack of a better term, to what was the moment of the narrative. Something was disrupting it, whether it was a past, a memory, or whether it was another piece of information, another detail that's left unsaid. Whatever the disruption was, it would come at that moment in time in the narrative, and if I tried to write it as a parenthetical or to just put it in the narrative, it never felt the same. It didn't feel as true to me as putting it as a footnote. And again, not really trying to think too much about it as I wrote the book, but after finishing the book, I think the point almost is the submersion and the subtext and the fact that those footnotes are literally at the bottom of the page, and you have to shift out. You have to shift down and read them at the bottom of the page, and that it is almost like an undercurrent, to continue the water metaphor. It, 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 they're an undercurrent. There are the things that are left unsaid. There are the things that we think about when we're in the middle of a conversation about something else entirely. They're the currents that are continuous.
Yeah, and they are accessible, which in David Foster Wallace's, they aren't unless you work really hard. And I'm not saying one is better or one isn't, but yours flow with the narrative. Oh, and since I'm such a pain in the ass, Dwayne Reed.
I know. You know, why did I think that everyone had Dwayne Reed pharmacies?
Because New York is the only city in the world for you. That's why.
I know, I'm terrible. Isn't that awful? I should have named him, I don't know, Walgreen or something. although I don't know if there are Walgreens all over the place either.
CVS
yes,
is
Dwayne maybe. Reed. I you know, was delighted with myself writing that, but you're absolutely right. You called me out. I just thought, if they're in New York.
Yeah, they are. That's the only place in the world they are.
I know. Well, at least Dwayne is a name, so people just probably not in New York just think, oh, his name is Dwayne Reed.
I think Dwayne Reed is owned by Walgreens, actually. I actually do think it is. But here's the thing, I was being the pain in the ass part, although pretty much most of the interview will be, is that Dwayne Reed, when he's thinking about the prostitute that he goes to, I'm saying, she
right.
should have put a footnote here. Because I was thinking, oh, yeah, I want to hear about his life because he's such an enigma because that's who he is. So when you said that, I go, oh, where's the footnote?
That's in the annotated version.
Oh, good. That'll sell more copies.
That's coming out in 3 years, the unabridged. I'm glad to hear you wanted more footnotes. You weren't enough with the footnotes already.
No, because they were all... Yeah, here's a question. Could you have written a novel that was just the footnotes? And then, you know, because I was thinking when I was reading, and I was thinking, this is where Abe is. He's not up there. He's down here. And like when Jules does what he does when Abe is on his deathbed, you know, those are the things in the book that make Abe what he is. The smile when he's not really around
mm-hmm.
and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be a different book. And you know, here's one. In one of the reviews, when Marie is in the woods watching what happened,
mm-hmm.
it says her parents were arrested. But
mm-hmm.
that's not what I read.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I didn't read it that way.
No.
I read it the other way.
Right, that they were killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's correct. Her whole family is.
And yeah, and the arresting part was like, that was stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so what happens is you go from... I mean, I've had this happen in my life where you go from the happiest and you made it that way, which kind of was very difficult. You made it that she was very happy, that his glasses are still on the table, that there's so many things that make her very, very happy at that moment. And then in the next moments, her life just turns upside down.
Right.
And then you have to live with that for the very, very rest of your life forever.
Right. Well, her footnotes, Marie's footnotes, really begin to take over.
Yeah.
In a sense, her and she's and they get longer and longer as the book goes on, and you get more and more of the story. But I didn't with that story of her background, which is loosely based on a friend of mine's mother's story, details taken a little bit from her mother's story and some other stories, which is the way it works for me. I mean, I'm just taking a little thing here or a little thing there and trying to put it together and see what happens. But for her, Marie's backstory, which is so traumatic, in a way, it's not that identifiable time, place, year, because I wanted it not to be about that, but just about any trauma, you know, that would happen, that the place that you go back to. For hers, it's particularly severe and horrible. But for some of the other characters, you know, what it is that they're going back to, is that for them as well?
You come at it in lots of different ways. You come at it like when Elizabeth gets the keys and sneaks into school.
Right.
What's she looking for with her flashlight? She's looking for the life that she doesn't know what it is. Although it seems like she has a pretty good life, but she's looking for, what is it that I can show that will explain the way Pete and my son and I have had a life? And they had a good life. I mean, they have a good life, and Pete's really funny.
Right. They have a great life.
So what happened?
I think it's just that all of the characters, in one way or another, are questioning who they are. And that comes, if we get back to your Voldemort question, that's because of thinking about themselves in relation to time, in relation to being seen, in a relation to being judged, known, however you want to put it. And I say this as if this is, again, I reiterate this, but it is important for me to say that that is not what I'm thinking when I'm writing the book. That's what I realize once I've finished it. But Elizabeth, who has a very nice life with Pete and her son Ben, she's thrown off by the school assignment to write the Who We Are stories, which is a school assignment. They're all supposed to come in with Who We Are stories. And suddenly it gets her on that hamster wheel, in a sense, of wondering, questioning, trying to figure out, well, what am I presenting? And what are others presenting? And are they really telling the truth about it? Or are they just giving us a composite that looks good? What's really going on? So I don't know if that answers your question, but I do think that it goes back to your earlier question about what are they all up against. And they're up against defining themselves against the onslaught of time, I guess.
Which really, unfortunately, really bothers me, because I'm 63. And then when you paint the picture of them in the ballet studio, when you have them painted with clothes on and then without, I'm thinking to myself, ooh, I'm kind of getting there, which really pissed me off.
Sorry.
It's all right. And then you're funny because you go the hamster wheel, but then you don't realize that you use hamster trance at least twice in there. You're stuck on hamsters.
I'm stuck on hamsters. It's the whole hamster genre. You know, I'm trying to get it going.
Next time you can work on guinea pigs, which actually is not a bad idea.
Right.
So the hamster trance, like, which Marie gets into and then Elizabeth gets into, what is it? Where did you hear it?
Hamster trance is something years ago a student of mine once said, and I thought it was so funny and so perfect as a concept. And it's in the book, Elizabeth accuses her husband Pete of getting into hamster trances, which is essentially, if anyone has ever seen hamsters and the way they run, and then all of a sudden they stop and stare at nothing as if they're in a trance, and then continue on and run. So I always thought that was such a great way of describing those moments when, in our frenzy, we're just taken out of it completely, God knows why, and then we're back in it.
Yeah, well, yeah, pretty much that's how we live our lives, I think.
Well, so you're free to use it. Just go hamster trance.
Which reminds me, for some strange reason, of one of the famous movie stars with the psychiatrist, who happens to be the same psychiatrist that, you know.
Right.
Well, and like at the very end of their session, when she says, "That's not your real name, is it?" And he goes, "No." "Well, what's your real name?" "I don't tell." And then he goes, "What does he say?" He says, "It's nothing. It's nothing. It doesn't mean anything."
Right.
And it's like, where did that come from? It's like I'm thinking, oh, that's really kind of interesting that he has totally sublimated his past, and he has a past too, which he talks about, but that his real name is gone.
Right, it's gone because he too, like all the rest of them, are trying to figure out where his place in history, or his place in the moment, and has probably been seduced by people's perception of who he is and how he must be, given his fame, that he's lost who he was, doesn't even know. And that's why he's sitting there talking to the psychiatrist, because he's trying to figure out how can he be somebody or know who he is when he's required to answer to the fans who believe him to be who they believe him to be by virtue of the fact of how he's projected, which is not who he is. Wow, that was a mouthful. I have no idea what I just said, but I think it made sense.
Well, that's because, you know, what you were saying before about not knowing what this is until it's over, like
right.
writing it. And that's why I think one of the reviews said something. It wasn't mean, but it said something like, you know, there's not much of a plot or something like that.
Right.
And it's not that there's not much of a plot. There is a plot. I know exactly what happened. I could write down a 500-word essay about what happened in this book.
Right.
But the plot is kind of, I would have to say, secondary to the characters and... there was another book I just interviewed that was the same situation. But it's secondary to the characters and not necessarily their interrelationship, although there are lots of them, but it's the characters and the fact that they're so well drawn. Wouldn't you say that it's more about them than what happens to them?
I think for me what was compelling, what drove me forward in a sense as I was working on this was, yes, the characters and how they related to one another, but also trying to capture what felt to me true about a particular moment in time in a particular neighborhood. It takes place in Chelsea in New York, and I lived in Chelsea for nearly 12 years and moved out of Chelsea and wrote the book once I had moved out of Chelsea. And I think I needed the distance of kind of looking back at the old neighborhood and thinking about it. And it was a particularly acute moment in time when I lived there, given 9/11, given Hurricane Sandy, given big bust in the economy and then big boom in that neighborhood around the High Line, the construction of the High Line in New York. And so in a way, I wanted to go back to Chelsea. I wanted to go back to that neighborhood. I was thinking about a lot of the things that had affected me when I lived there. And so, it was about capturing what was particular about that moment in time. But it could have been from any neighborhood, really, and it could be in any city. I think I also started to get excited about the way the characters relate to one another as being very much kind of what happens in urban settings. You know, I remember when we moved out of Chelsea, maybe a year before or so, I opened the door and walked down the steps, and there was a box of plastic horses, little horses, and with a note from one of my neighbors saying, "My girls don't play with these anymore. Maybe your children would like some." And I have no idea who she was or he was. They just left them on the stoop. And that's a very city interaction, I think, whereas there's a sense that there's this kind of connectivity, but also in an anonymity.
Yeah, it's funny because I do this a lot. I don't know how come it happens. It's almost Jungian. But when I was reading this book, I was on the High Line.
Oh, you were?
I was on the High Line. And then I was at, 29th and 8th. And uh-huh. I was reading part of it, too. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. Am I in this book? Is this, where am I? It's like the never-ending story or something where there is no fourth wall. And I'm going, I wonder if actually I'm just being written about now.
Right.
And it's a really cool feeling. But it's like I'm reading about the High Line, and it's just at the moment that I'm reading it that I'm there and just kind of catches you off guard.
Right.
So who is Very Grand and how does she come about?
Very Grand is literally an oil painting in Marie's apartment. And that was inspired by an elderly friend of mine who has a beautiful oil painting in her apartment of a portrait of a very grand-looking woman. And I have no idea whether she's related to this woman or whether she just thinks it's a great portrait and likes to have it on her wall. And so I put it into Marie's apartment, and it began to take on a life of its own, because in Marie and Abe's life, they had this portrait. She was a relative of Abe's, and not known really to either one of them. And so they started making up histories for her and calling her very grand. And then she becomes personified in a way, because she then starts looking out at Marie and every once in a while commenting on what's going on in Marie's life. And I think that her presence, just like the presence of some other objects in Marie's apartment and objects in Elizabeth's apartment and objects in the novel overall, and I get back to that idea of the impermanence of permanence, or the sense of the impermanence of the sense of permanence, you know, objects do remain permanent and kind of are carried through generations sometimes. And that was interesting to me, and to play around with, and the fact that you could have this portrait of a complete stranger on your wall and live with this portrait of a complete stranger without knowing anything about her background.
We had that too. I have an old house, 1775, and there's this staircase that kind of winds down. And we had this picture on the wall of this woman. It looked like she was on the same staircase, and she was descending the staircase, and she had a martini glass in her hand. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing. I just assumed that she was coming from a party at our house down the stairs. And yeah. And I like, you do play with it, because at the very end, I like when her feet get wet.
Right, when the water starts to rise.
Well, it must really be rising fast at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But so Helen, who's there, but is not there as much as Marie or Simone, why is it that Helen is the one who paints the scenes showing the city and St. Pat's, you know, underwater? Why is she the one that you chose to paint the scene, as opposed to, say, Marie or Simone, even though Marie's not that good at painting?
So Helen is in this art class with Marie and Simone in the book, and Helen was inspired, the character of Helen was inspired by my best friend's mother, who took an art class in New York for 20 years, 5 days a week. She would go across the park and sit with the same group and paint. And years ago, she showed me one of the paintings that she had done. This is before global warming, before any talk of, you know, weather changes. She showed me this painting, and she had painted a picture of St. Patrick's Cathedral underwater with fish swimming around. And so when I started writing that scene with Marie and Simone in the art class, suddenly my friend's mother, whose name was Jane, suddenly Jane is there as Helen, the art historian, and she's painting something comparable. But now it's got much more meaning, because now there's talk of flooding and things underwater. So she was a pretty minor character in the book until I had been working on the book maybe a year, year and a half, and I saw Jane, and I said, Jane, you know, I've got this character in my book who's sort of loosely inspired by you, because she's in a painting class, and she's painting this painting, which I remember is similar to the one I remember you showed me years and years ago. And Jane said, oh, you mean the sunken cathedral? And I said, is that what you called it? And she said, yes, it's after the Debussy prelude. And I said, oh, as if I knew what she was talking about. And I'm embarrassed to say to you, since you knew this work so well, I didn't know it. And, you know, there are these things sometimes happen when you're working on a book, when suddenly it's as if the universe is giving you clues to how to proceed.
Yep.
So Jane said that about the sunken cathedral, and I then went and did a little research and learned that it's not only is it a work that's considered one of the first works of musical impressionism, and I had in my painting class in the book Sid Morris, the instructor, talking about impressionism all the time, but also then I learned the legend that had inspired Debussy, which was a legend of the lost city of Wise off the coast of northern France. Because of an evil daughter to a king who steals the keys from her father and opens the door during a tempest, the entire city is drowned, and the inspiration for the sunken cathedral, or you'll say it better than me, I'm sure, with my very limited French background. I think it's L'Anglicé Cathedrale, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Which is sometimes translated as the engulfed cathedral,
right,
or the sunken cathedral. But anyway, so that was that on particular clear days, you can still hear the bells of the cathedral. And learning that in my research after Jane told me what she had named her painting, it was as if all of a sudden about 10 puzzle pieces fit.
There's a lot of stuff to fit, and it really explains the way you were saying your writing style is, because
right,
like when Marie, after she breaks her ankle, she hear the pain is a bell far away, you know?
Right.
Did you mean that?
I did. She hears bells often, and the book actually ends with the bells. But
right.
In Chelsea, there's the General Seminary, and the bells there, when I live there, and I think still, also ring every, I don't know if they ring every hour, but they ring every day, and there were certain moments, historical moments, through those years I was there, when they would also ring to mark anniversaries or some particular event that had happened. So there was something very mournful about them, but also something very timeless about them.
There is. Mm. And, you know, thinking about people being good in the book, if you think about Helen and her father reading to her and asking her if, you know, of course I know what this, I know what Impressionism is. And then he says, you're the smartest girl in the world. And then he picks up the phone and says, you know, President Eisenhower says,
yeah,
no, I made a mistake. You know, I mean, I try to be that way with my kids. I don't know if I am. I don't even know if it's a good thing to do. But it just, and maybe that reminded you of somebody or your father or something, but it's just such a wonderful thing to do for a child. You know? Isn't it?
Right. Yes. I mean, I loved the sense of his play, the
yeah,
father. I think that kids love nothing more than when you're as wild as you can possibly be with your imagination. You know, we're all so tired. It's hard to be. But my sense of her father was that he just was this extraordinary figure in her life. She really loved her father. And he was the one who told her the story of the sunken cathedral, but also he just seemed to be the one. I portray her as being a kind of a, you know, kind of a homely girl, not one that, very shy, not one that would probably get a lot of attention. And so her father's the one who brings out everything in her, and that, that was just the way that he came across in the writing of it. And so
the fathers are the same. Ben's father, Jules' father, Helen's father. They're all good fathers.
I hadn't thought of that. The good father. That's the name of my next book, Fayusha.
Will you dedicate it to me?
The good father. Who does not slip into hamster trances. I have to get the hamsters in there. The good hamster father.
Well, you know, it's funny. Even the unknown tragedy of Miles Whitbread, you know, it's like,
right,
even that's a kind of good thing. Well, no, it's a horrible thing, but it's, never mind. It's just that it all seems like, you know, it's like if you think of the universe and you think of it, like if you're swimming through this blue sea forever and then you pop up your head and you look around for 60 or 70 years and then you pop back down and you swim through it for all eternity again, you have a little bit of choice in what you do during that time that your head is above the water. And it seems like all the characters, I don't know, to use it like Star Wars, they're going towards the right side of the force. They all are pushing towards the right side of the force. Nature is pushing against them, but they all seem to be kind of, you know, going the right way, because you can choose to or not.
I never thought of it that way, but what does maybe that means? I just instinctively feel people are good.
Do you think that?
I actually do. I think that that people can make horrible choices and do horrible things, but I do think that essentially that often in their own view of themselves and view of what they were trying to do, they were somehow trying to do good.
And I think that pushes the universe in a certain way, maybe a tiny, minuscule, tiny, 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 tiny way.
Right.
But I think it does. And it's hard to write a book, but now I understand it because of the process that you don't know what you've written until you've written it. Now I can understand how it comes about, because you don't realize you're creating this, I don't know, you're creating this, in my case, kind of magic. And I'm wondering, how can that happen without he who cannot be named? How can that happen if they're all moving the right way? How can it be that they're all moving the right way, and not only that, but remembering things the right way, even if what they're remembering happened to be a tragedy, because they were forgiven, or because the person's still with them, or because the person was so good and Jules got into bed and made sure he didn't touch his father. You know,
right.
All really good things that are well thought out in the human brain.
Well, maybe I'm just showing them their best sides.
Do you think you've done that in your other books? Because,
well, it's so interesting. It's so interesting to hear you define it that way, because I think often, there's a sense that I'm kind of writing about darker things.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so it's interesting to hear you say that you're seeing all these characters as being good. I mean, I certainly see them as being good. And it sounds trite to say it, but I actually do like all of my characters. I don't write a character that I don't like. I mean, I might write a character that's doing something I wouldn't do, but I like is probably the wrong word. I try to truly, you know, be as close as possible to them and to what they're thinking and how they're viewing the world and why they're making the decisions they're making. And so in doing that, then I don't want to judge them.
Yeah, but
I don't want to say here's poor, you know, Sally.
Yeah, but you're really...
She did all the wrong things, and let's look at poor Sally doing all the wrong things and make this kind of collective, horrible judgment about her.
But you even push against it, because, like, when the cop comes to mm-hmm. get Elizabeth, I'm mm-hmm. thinking, oh, here comes a bad guy. Well, here comes a bad guy, and it turns out to be the nicest guy in the world, and he's got his backstory, too. And I thought he's going to come there, handcuff or whatever, and even he was like, you know, Santa Claus. He was a great guy, and his horse and all that stuff, you know, it just, and his dog,
right.
You know,
right.
It's, I don't know, it's just funny. It's funny, but it's really, really nice, and it really made the book such a pleasure to read.
Well, thank you.
So, anyway, so we've been talking for 53 minutes.
Oh, my gosh. Do you make your poor listeners listen to 53 minutes of this, or do you edit me down?
Oh, I don't care about the listeners. I ignore them. I'm just, do you think they haven't read it yet, and I'm talking about all these things. I feel bad. I mean, we're supposed to be selling.
And then this part, you didn't even ask me. I thought you were going to ask me about M&M World, because I was going to tell you, you know, I never went to M&M World.
Well,
I never went. When I wrote that story, I did not go to M&M World.
Well, it sounded like you didn't want to, that's for sure.
I didn't want to, and I didn't go. And then the New Yorker being the New Yorker, they wanted to fact check all this stuff.
So
suddenly I had to go there to see if it was in fact true that, you know, M&M World sold little, I don't know, keychains that had M&M World stamped on them, or whatever I had put in as the detail of the store.
So
and I got it, the amazing thing, and this is sort of a sad statement about commercialism, I guess, is that I got it right. There was one thing I made up that wasn't exactly true in the store, including, and I was very excited about this, the people who work there, you know, when they have to have their name and then where they're from?
Yep.
Right. I just guessed that that would be the case at M&M World, like Disney World. And it was true, because I would have been very sorry to have to lose that in the story.
What do you think about the Disneyfication of Times Square? Do you like wish it was somewhere in the middle between what it was and what it is?
Right. I don't know. I can't say that I hugely miss the old Times Square.
Well, you don't go up that way anyway, because you're
in
New Yorker.
No, I'm not there that often. Yeah. And also, you know, it's not really, it's a place now that's just a whole different place.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different thing. But they're building a new Midtown destination, the West Side. That one, I forget what it's called, but it'll be the next Times Square.
There's so many. Well, look at Brooklyn, for God's sakes. You know, who would have thought?
Right,
but,
I know.
But what I was going to say, though, was when my little girl was little and she was in Target with her friend and I looked around and I couldn't find them, what happens is you start screaming and it's like all your inhibitions are lost. You just scream their name as loud as you can. It doesn't make any difference who's hearing it, what's happening in the store. You just scream and you
right.
grab people who work there and you tell them what's happened and you just like, you totally, you know, they're so important to you that it makes no difference what a fool you make of yourself or what they think of you.
And it's horrible where your mind goes.
Oh,
in just
God.
A split second when, you know, they're probably just standing over with the backpacks in aisle 6 and your mind is just racing to all these horrendous scenarios. I got several letters after I published that story from people telling me stories of
well, that's the thing. When you find the kid, he doesn't know or she doesn't know anything that they did wrong, and you
right.
have to use all of your willpower not to slap him around and say, if you ever do that again, I'm going to kill you. So you have to still be the good parent, but it's so hard. You're emotionally exhausted. You're about ready to have a heart attack, especially
right.
when the sister says, you know, when he went off with that guy.
Right.
See, now, look, I give everything away.
Yes. My,
you know,
thanks a lot.
It's only a short story. I can do that.
That's all right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, this was so much fun talking to you.
It was great to talk to you. Thank you. And thank you for that introduction. My word. I'm going to use every line you'd said.
Shoot.
I'm just going to steal it for various things.
It's funny, though. Those introductions that I do for these interviews, they come to me because, giving myself credit, I read the book closely. So since I read it closely, I pretty much know what it's about, unless it's either a bad book or it's totally inaccessible. And so then when I read it, it's like, okay, this is what it's about. And then I just spit out what it's about. And that's what makes a book good, I think. And that's why yours is so good.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate it.
Okay.
And thank you for doing the podcast and, you know, getting the word out.
You're welcome. I hope we talk again soon.
Me too.
That was Kate Walbert talking about her book, The Sunken Cathedral, which, as I said, is a piece by Debussy, who is my favorite, and, you know, Clair de Lune and Afternoon of a Faun and all those things. They're so evocative to me. And when I was little and when I listened to that music, it made me think that there was some other world where things like this happened, kind of blurry, musical, color-laden, not a world that I could encounter on a day-to-day waking reality basis, but one that would occur in my dreams or dreams that were real and things like that. So I think she did a really good job, Kate, in creating a book named after a piece of music that ended up instead being, no, in addition to that, ended up being a book that was about people, their pasts, their futures, some of it hidden behind water, some of it not, but for the most part, as we discussed, good people doing good things, having memories that might be good or bad, and what they planned for their future and what that future actually was like. So, good book. Anyway, so next couple of weeks, I'm juggling things around, but we have lots of good authors coming up, especially people who just had their work published, and Rebecca, as always, is constantly ahead of the curve, picking books that you know will be popular. Like when I interviewed Gillian Flynn for Gone Girl, well before it became popular. Or Jennifer Egan for Visit from the Goon Squad, well before it won the Pulitzer Prize. And Tinkers by Paul Harding. Somehow she's able to find these things, knowing that they're going to be good, knowing they're going to be respected and awarded. and it makes it so much easier for me. Plus, it gives me a chance to scoop Terry Gross, which is a big deal. In any event, thank you, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. Come back and see us, hear us, next week when we talk to another great author, hopefully as nice and as funny as Kate was today.